Welcome, Bankless Nation, back to the roundtable. We're back in session today. The man with glutinous glutes, 0x bread guy, good to see you.
Hey, guys.
And today, at the top of Ethereum's most wanted list, to John Charbonneau.
Kill him.
And then, of course, the world's most zen DJ, Andy 8052. He is out golfing, so it's just us two today. Bread. John, good to see you guys. We riffed it with Ryan Chen Adams last week, but it's good to have two of the boys back in session this week. I want to get this week started off with kind of just an overall vibe check. There's like a lot of activity. There's a lot of buzz. There's a lot of
animal
engagement
spirits
going around in crypto. Animal spirits feel present right now in the crypto industry. There's two tweets that are kind of echoing around, one from Intern. State of the crypto markets, they say, ICOs are back, apps are generating revenue, crypto IPO going parabolic, Bitcoin tapping all-time highs, stablecoin growth with no end in sight, and then Bitcoin accumulation vehicles popping off left and right. And then another tweet from Ansem saying, appetite for crypto exposure has never been higher. Various entities alongside Taylor buying multi-billions of Bitcoin. Circle is a lot of the same thing. Circle IPO, 25 oversubscribed, 5x unopened. Plasma, $500 million ICO filled in 2 minutes. Play market and X integration, and then also the United States government actively pursuing regulatory clarity. A lot of reasons to be bullish. I feel pretty bullish about the second half of this year. I feel like the second half of this year could get frothy. That's not my base case, but my base case is like at least a slow grind up. So I want to kind of get a sentiment check from you guys about what you think the next, like, you know, second half of this year will look like.
Oh, that's tough. Like, you know, like we've all seen the structural bullishness that was in place for this to happen, right? It went all the way back to like the ETF inflows, loosened regulatory frameworks of like just say, hey, like there's appetite for this thing. So like I think we've all loosely like thought directionally this would happen, but in a volatile Trump market, like there's like the path was never going to be a straight line up. I still don't think it's not going to be just like, oh, we're just grind up from here. It's going to be fine, guys. No, something is going to happen over the next 6 months that's going to scare the bejesus out of us. But then we have to look back to stuff like this and go like, guys, we're fine. Like there is some fundamental structural stuff that like is bullish for us. And we need to stay aware of that. But yeah, like this has always been kind of what we were hoping for. Just like it will pull up. It's not just going to be a slow grind. I'm confident of that.
So I'm hearing neither affirm nor deny.
I'm holding my options. They're expired at the end of the year. I think those are a good move. But yeah, man, I know I'm going to have to white knuckle probably for a few weeks between here and there.
Okay, so you're saying by the end of this year, we will be higher than we are today. And in addition to that, there will be one of those big tweets from that one Twitter account that says like $500 billion has been liquidated from the crypto markets in the past like 2 hours. Like one of those
of
two.
Of course. Yeah. Okay. We always get out over our skis because we're feeling this, like we're rattling off lists of like, guys, it's a new paradigm. And then like, that's when everyone's like, they long at the top. And then I just did it last week. I told you like, I entered my first perp position. I longed at the top and the ass fell out. So like, okay, like, you know what? Okay, I've got to grab this thing for a little bit. So revisit these kind of lists and say like, guys, we're fine. Like some of these things will carry out. And I think it's going to be no different.
John, what do you think?
I was listening to a podcast yesterday where they brought up Supercycle more times than made me comfortable, which is more than zero.
Yeah, I mean, I broadly agree. If this administration is good for anything, it is good for volatility. Uh-huh. There is going to be periods between now and the end of the year where we question everything, probably back down on the downside. I just wouldn't be surprised by that. But at the same time, the just broader setup for the space is really just great right now, where... I mean, back on the just higher level of, I mean, where is the administration? Where are politics? The environment is just so much more positive where, I mean, we saw in the past week, I mean, like the SEC was having a bunch of the industry leaders come in and talk about the industry. Like they want to openly engage, you know, people were retweeting the tweets of Paul Atkins.
Do you think we're represented well in those instances where they pull people in to actually have conversations? Because like that's always been the question, right? It's like, you know, in the past we've had those conversations, but it was, you know, SBF. And it's like, that actually did more damage, right?
Right. I think represented incredibly well this time around.
Yeah. I would say that we were represented very well. My partner at TPA was one of the speakers that they had at this event, Michael Jordan.
So you're obligated to say.
So John says, yes, we are represented.
I think we were represented incredibly well in Washington. But it really is just an amazing tone shift to see the SEC and other regulators that are very actively reaching out to us because they want to engage, they want to get this right. And we see that in the enforcement actions, the guidance that they're giving, where last year it was they were sending enforcement actions And the past week, we are looking at the SEC tweeting out how DeFi fits in the American spirit, and we want to respect self-custody for users. Like that. That's still just a crazy shift for me to see in the past year. And on the legislative front, we're obviously seeing strong progress on the Genius Bill is moving forward for stablecoins. We'll see where market structure bill goes after that. Hopefully that gets pushed forward. But very broadly, the macro setup is there. This is being accepted as a real asset class. The framework is being built for us to actually be able to mature the industry. So the onus is really on us to build the products that take advantage of, hey, you can go build mature real products now. Like, please go do that. And I think that we are starting to see signs of that as well in the industry. And then you are seeing the institutional demand for the product as well, as evidenced by, we'll talk about this later, but the Circle IPO, which was the biggest left curve, mid curve between, you know, what was the right take on this IPO versus what was CT saying about it going in. And it's very fitting too. I feel like I've seen a lot of tweets over the past few months or so, 6 months plus, where a lot of people that you talk to who speak to more institutional investors and people who are looking at crypto from the outside, larger money managers and the like, versus you compare their sentiment to what is CT sentiment, has just been the widest gap that you've ever seen. And I think something like the Circle IPO was a very representative of that, where everyone on CT for the past few weeks was just mega bearish on this. It was the margins are compressing. Coinbase makes all the money on this. Like, how do you justify this valuation? And then they list it, and boom, 25x oversubscribed. The thing rips 5x over the next few days, and like, here we are.
Do you think it's because it's so simple? Why?
Yeah, I'd actually like to pull this apart.
I think people really want stablecoin exposure. Yeah. I think it's really, really, I think it was really that simple.
So it's a narrative trade. It's a narrative play. Like, there's, I think we would all be in agreement that the fundamentals of the Circle business does not at all justify its valuation.
I agree with that. And then, I mean, there's some degree of fundamentals versus what is the short-term price. You know, if you bought the Grayscale Bitcoin ETPs a few years ago because that was the only thing that you could access and you wanted to express a bet on Bitcoin, was that a bad bet or a good bet? Depending on where you bought it, I mean, it was a bad bet in the sense that, I mean, you're paying twice what is the underlying literally worth. Right. But you had the right macro bet, and over a long enough time horizon, if that's the only way that you're allowed to express your bet, maybe that is a rational thing for you to do. As someone who is able to take much more, let's say, nuanced and directed bets on, I think there's going to be a lot of stablecoin growth. What are the protocols I want to invest in to profit off of that? Whether that's DeFi projects or what other early startups, I think that there are better alternatives. But the reality is, for a lot of people, they do not have access to those alternatives. They don't have the sophistication or the desire to invest in those alternatives. They see, this is the big regulatory stamp approved. This is the nice whitelisted, white glove, American USDC stablecoin provider. Yeah. And they're a public company now. I can go buy this thing. Is it expensive based on comparables? Yeah, it is. But I really want exposure to this thing. And so people were going into it. I think it's that simple. I think there's a scarcity effect that people really want stablecoin exposure. And there's limited opportunities to do that, particularly in a public markets way. So I think people just really, really wanted exposure to that.
In the wild west of DeFi, stability and innovation are everything, which is why you should check out Frax Finance, the protocol revolutionizing stablecoins, DeFi, and Rollups. So the core of Frax Finance is Frax USD, which is backed by BlackRock's institutional Biddle Fund. Frax designed Frax USD for best-in-class yields across DeFi, T-bills, and carry trade returns all in one. Just head to frax.com, then stake it to earn some of the best yields in DeFi. Want even more? Bridge your Frax USD over to the Fraxtl Layer 2 for the same yield plus Fraxtl points, and explore Fractal's diverse Layer 2 ecosystem with protocols like Curve, Convex, and more, all rewarding early adopters. Frax isn't just a protocol. It's a digital nation powered by the FXS token and governed by its global community. Acquire FXS through Frax.com or your go-to DEX, stake it, and help shape Frax Nation's future. Ready to join the forefront of DeFi? Visit Frax.com now to start earning with Frax USD and staked Frax USD. And for Bankless listeners, you can use Frax.com/r/Bankless when bridging to Fraxtl for exclusive Fraxtl perks and boosted rewards. Uniswap is your gateway to a more efficient DeFi experience. With Uniswap, swapping and bridging across 13 chains is simple, fast, and cost-effective, helping you move value wherever, whenever. Thanks to deep liquidity on the Uniswap protocol, you'll enjoy minimal price impact on every trade. And now Uniswap V4 takes it even further. Swappers benefit from gas savings on multi-hop swaps and ETH trading pairs, while liquidity providers can create new pools at 99% lower costs. The best part, you don't have to do anything extra. Each trade is automatically routed through Uniswap V2X, V2, V3, and V4, so you get the most efficient swap without even thinking about it. Whether you're swapping, sending, on-ramping, off-ramping, or bridging, Uniswap's web app and wallet gives you the tools to unlock DeFi's full potential on Ethereum, Base, Arbitrum, Unichain, and more. Use Uniswap's web app and wallet for a more efficient way to use DeFi.
Okay, so Circle right now is trading at $106. That's about $25 billion. Just for reference, comped to Coinbase. Coinbase is like $65 billion. And Coinbase has like 30 or 40% of the revenue coming out of Circle, out of USDC. And so there's just a huge mismatch here. Like, why would Circle be valued at $25 billion when like Coinbase is valued at 65? And like, yes, you could just be like, I don't care what it is. I want stablecoin exposure. Circle is the only thing I can do to get stablecoin exposure. Therefore, I'm going to slam buy. To me, like, I can't really differentiate that between somebody being like, yeah, like I want access to blockchain technology, and, you know, banks running blockchain technology are the future. Therefore, I'm going to buy Ripple. Like, the disconnect between fundamentals and actual like reality is just so large here. Like, I'm guessing you're not buying Circle. Brett, you're not buying. Hey, I don't think anyone on crypto Twitter can like justify buying Circle at a $25 billion valuation. And so what one half of me is like, well, you know, we all just mid-curved it because the thing to do was to clearly to buy, at least in this moment of time. But I'll like project forward, you know, 5 years, be like, well, will it justify itself then? Maybe we're not right now. We're just early. But then also, like, being early is also being wrong. I don't really know how to think about it.
I think it's mostly commentary on just like the size of our ecosystem, right? Yes, we have awareness of all these comps within the ecosystem that we can look to like Tether and say like, look, Tether is dunking on Circle in every measurable like factor. And like we have awareness of it. We can't get exposure to it, but like we have awareness of it. So it allows us to like look at it, say it's not the best, it's not whatever. And then just like the relative capital size of players in our ecosystem to the gargantuan TradFi world, like the public markets, right? Like this could be the splash on effects of just like a bunch of people in that market that just want to get exposure to it. And as Sean said, this is the only thing they can do. So it's just like, yeah, they could pump this thing to 26 bills. And like, that's not really that big of a deal to them in their market. Cause it's like that, this is what we can do. And this is the splash on effects of our capital size relative to us, where it's like, that's a big thing. Like this, like all of this was a crazy move, and yeah, we couldn't move it to quite this degree because we're just a small fish, right? Relative to the global markets.
Yeah. So one of the funny tweets I saw, someone did the math of, I don't remember the exact number, but it was basically if you take the current multiples that Circle's trading at, and if you throw that on top of Tether, like, oh yeah, we get an implied valuation of like $1 trillion or something like that. Yeah,
right. Yeah. Is that Rob?
And so do you
Dragonfly?
Actually think it's worth that? No, probably not. And so I do not own any exposure to Circle right now because I can't justify the current prices based on, you know, what I think are reasonable expectations. But
you're not dumb enough to short it?
Yeah, I'm not shorting anything in crypto. I have no plans to do that at all. Like they are a great business, and I wish them success. I mean, that's separate from, you know, what do I think the short term price is going to be. But even as someone who doesn't hold any of it, the sentiment has been super positive around crypto, around this, and as it should be, because this is a great, really healthy sign for the industry, showing, hey, there is a lot of demand for this. This is something that people take seriously. This is another step in the maturation process of, we have another big listed public company. What is this very likely to do for all of those other crypto companies that were considering going public at some point in the medium term? Maybe they were thinking about going public next year. Those timelines are probably being pulled up. I saw one of the tweets was Gemini, I believe. Mm-hmm. They were pulling forward their timeline to looking to file. There's a number of other exchanges, another operator.
The race is on to go public right now.
Yeah. This was a very clear sign that, hey, the market's open now for this. And so that is super healthy and really, really positive for us to see. And that has trickled down effects throughout the rest of the funding and startups and all the other projects in crypto that are downhill of that.
It would be interesting to see the price performance of Gemini post IPO, because Gemini is an exchange. So it's going to get comped to Coinbase, not to Circle, but it's Circle that is the firing gun for Gemini's like being okay. Like it's we're good to go. And Kraken is going to be the same. Like Kraken's probably making similar moves. And as a coin holder, I was excited for Circle to go live because I was hoping that like positive valuation would blow back onto my coin bags, which didn't really happen. And so there's an interesting juxtaposition there of like, oh yeah, Gemini, Kraken chomping at the bit to go public, but their comp is
Coinbase, not Circle. And so, like, I don't know if the market's going to give them, maybe unless there's like a fresh chart premium for you know, IPOing. I don't know. I don't know if that exists in TradFi. What do you guys think about that?
I broadly agree. I think the really, really strong demand right now is for stable coins in particular. And that's the niche that Circle was filling. And so I don't think that these other ones are going to fill that exact same gap. But nonetheless, I still think it is a very healthy sign that you have, just showing, hey, there is market demand for institutional grade crypto products right now. This is something that institutional investors want to be investing in now that we have all the clarity. So it's a good sign nonetheless. I agree that it would be even better if they were the third biggest stablecoin issuer to go and IPO right now. That would probably be the thing that you want to do even more. But it's a positive sign nonetheless. And how well they go will be a good indicator, though, of how broad this demand is and how does that bode for other crypto companies that are potentially considering. Because I assume that it's very possible Gemini or someone like them is next in line. And so we'll see what the demand there versus how isolated was this just to crazy stablecoin demand, which is possible.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we are 6 months into the Trump presidency. So like Coinbase went public 2021, really before the Biden SEC crackdown on crypto. So they just got in right before that gate shut. And then we had just, you know, 4 dark years. And now, you know, Trump comes in, opens up the gate, people start to go public. And now there's like kind of a lineup, right? So MicroStrategy also was able to finagle their way into like becoming a Bitcoin acquisition company because they were already public. But now, like Joseph Lubin and SBET, and like there's another Ethereum acquisition vehicle company, and now there's like Bitcoin copycats, and it's like Sol Strategies, and now there's also Circle, and then Gemini and Kraken, and Anchorage, and I don't know, Chainalysis. They all want to go public. So there's a growing number of ways to get crypto exposure, or potentially soon, by the end of this year or early next year, there will be like a pretty like rich number of ways to get exposure to crypto in TradFi. And without even like having to actually to go into the crypto industry, which is kind of interesting. I'm curious as to like how that market equilibrates when there's a variety of different ways to get exposure. Again, even in addition to the ETFs too. And you don't even have to like join the industry. You can all just do it from like Robinhood or your brokerage or whatever.
You had me curious. Like, obviously, we all know Circle and Tether, the two biggest, or USDC and Tether, the two biggest coins. Like, okay, like, what is the third biggest stable? Is there another stablecoin IPO on the horizon that we could like even like realistically look towards? And there's basically nothing. Like, there's
Paxos.
Market caps. Yeah, the market cap for Tether and USDC are 150 billion to 60 billion. The next biggest, which is Athena's USDE, is 6 billion. So like the fall off is a 10x below USDC. And then like then it's DAI, Sky Dollar, BlackRock, Builder, then even like World Liberty Financials, like US dollar, whatever the hell it is.
Paxos isn't on there. Like Paxos is like a stablecoin whitelister. So it's not going to have
it's like an infrastructure. Yeah.
Yeah. But like it's not going to command any sort of like premium that Circle did. Okay. So question for you guys. To like $160 billion of stablecoins on Ethereum, and ETH BTC is like, you know, I have seen tribally indifferent profit maxis be posting about the ETH BTC ratio. Like it's been flat for 3 months for the first time in 2 years. Stablecoins dominantly on Ethereum, we know this. But then also Bitcoin dominance is just creeping up and up and up and up. I put out this tweet, which for some reason like triggered a bunch of people. Max Payne is 75% Bitcoin dominance and no altcoin season. And for the record, we are at 64% Bitcoin dominance. Going from 64% to 75% is a big move. It's like a much larger move than going from like 40% to 50%, because that, you know, as there's more Bitcoin dominance, it's harder to become even more dominant. So there's a lot of people like interpreting this tweet differently. But like for some reason, I feel like there's some horseshoe phenomenon where you have like stable coins on one side and Bitcoin on the other. And when stablecoin growth is big, it goes all the way back around and it validates Bitcoin. And then like the Ethereum, the pro Ethereum side of things, it's like, well, no, Ethereum is the stablecoin blockchain. There's $160 billion of stablecoins on Ethereum. Brad, what do you think?
I hate that I keep like going back to this. Like ETH technology could be great for stablecoins. It doesn't necessarily mean ETH the asset goes up. Like, that's the problem. That's the problem. Like, there's structural stuff in place that, like, the PSYOP Bitcoin bulls can, like, people are just going to buy it because you always think there's going to be a next buyer, right? You always think the next buyer is the nation state, or it's the government, or it's the whatever, someone on a treasury. Like, it gives everyone confidence to buy this thing because you can peg the next buyer on that thing. Where it's like, ETH is delivering all these technical properties that are fucking awesome for stable coins, right? Like, it's great. I want to have my assets there. It's credibly neutral. It's decentralized. But, like, I don't need to have ETH the asset in order to, like, not in size, in order to have my stable coins be settled to and transferred in and denominated in on Ethereum mainnet. So it's like, without high velocity there and, like, bringing execution back to it, like, I think that is the unfortunate truth. Is like, I can say, yeah, stable coins are on Ethereum. That's fucking great. Like, they belong there. Ethereum's awesome. Doesn't necessarily mean the asset has to go up.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a difference between, like, a stablecoin exchange and a stablecoin vault. And Ethereum, I think, is a very big stablecoin vault. And I don't know how much, like, DEX, stablecoin DEX volumes there are. I mean, there are definitely an ample supply, but enough to generate fees. John, what do you think?
The perfect test case, it's kind of funny. I mean, we just debated. Ryan Berkmans had actually tweeted out, pulling up the tweet, was it a couple of days ago, of Tether makes billions a year on their ETH business, but their BTC maxis and alt L1 launchers. Meanwhile, ETH's on track to become a multi-trillion-dollar asset without a Tether bid. Let's see if Tether ends up FOMOing ETH when they see BTC as the first, but not the only special snowflake. To which I replied, or they're the perfect example of why Ethereum providing value does not equal ETH capturing value. Tether is the quintessential example of, they have built a gigantic profitable business, which in large part does use Ethereum with a bunch of Tether there. They use the chain obviously very, very heavily. And you can go check Paolo's tweets and, you know, what is Tether holding? It's Bitcoin and gold. And so it is that still very barbell of, hey, we can use the chain, but still kind of just be Bitcoin maxis. And so where does that go in the future? If there's increasingly even more stablecoin issuance on Ethereum, is that positive for Ethereum enough? People debate this one all the time, like how positive it is for your chain if there's a bunch of RWAs on there. My gut is it's still positive. It's just that we do have to realize that there is a difference in value accrual between, hey, someone puts $100 billion or whatever, some crazy number of T-bills, dollars, whatever, that's sitting on this chain. It really is just idle capital that's not moving. Maybe a SEC has it off chain or whatever. This is just, you know, a money market fund that someone has a bunch of money just sitting there and the off-chain issuer is just clipping all the money, versus we have a bunch of money on chain that's high velocity capital and is being traded a lot, is actively producing a lot of fees. Those are obviously qualitatively different and do have quantitative results on, you know, what is the value capture for the base asset. And so Ethereum is more in that former camp of a lot of the capital there is it's winning in the size of capital and it's not currently winning in a lot of the velocity of capital metrics, things like trading volume and a lot of user metrics. And so it's definitely still positive in my mind to be winning the institutional capital and a lot of big money going there. But it's definitely not a one-to-one comparison. And so looking at it simplistically, I think just doesn't hold up, obviously.
I hate that, like, everyone's tying winning or, like, success to just, like, raw dollars. Like, the price going up. Like, that's what's, like, that's the fight everyone's having, right? It's like, it's doing great. Like, it's service, like, it's doing all of these things. It's servicing its purpose. Like, it has this crypto ethos. Like, it's doing all of that. But everyone views it as a failure because price isn't going up. And, like, unless my bags are going up, like, this thing sucks, right? Like, and, like, that's not really the case. Maybe there's an acceptance where it's just like, and, like, I've talked about, like, the compression lower of, like, all these infrastructure plays. Like, you know what? Maybe all these things will serve their purpose and, like, facilitate app growth. And, like, all of them will kind of just, like, sit where they are. They don't all have to go up infinitely for this to be a successful thing. And, like, if that's the future of this world, like, maybe that's just how it's going to play out.
I think there's, like, two common trains of thought, which will put you in two different conclusions, depending on which one you are. There's one that is like, okay, in 1 to 2 years, there's going to be 10x of as much real world assets tokenized on Ethereum as there are today. And then, like, the ETH bull will say, and just by proxy of that, ETH will be bullish. Just by association, just, like, at some point, BlackRock is going to have so much assets under management on Ethereum that they're just going to want ETH by proxy of that. And people in their orbit will also just want ETH by proxy of that. You know, how much demand does that create? Uncertain. Maybe not a whole lot, but, like, still, like, 10xing real world assets on Ethereum is going to, you know, have a huge halo effect around the Ethereum brand and Ether the asset, and that's bullish. And like, I think that's somewhat true.
I agree with that.
I think that's mostly true. And then there's like, like the John Charbonneau's, which is like, show me the mechanism for how it captures value. And if it's not there, then I'm buying Bitcoin. And I kind of understand that too. Like, they're one's like a little bit of a narrative play. It's a little bit looser. It's a little bit more about belief about the network and the growth of the network. And then the other one's a little bit, no, like, no, show me the burn. Show me the value accrual. I want to see the burn. And it's like, I see that one. I see that one as well.
Yeah.
Both are going to happen.
Yeah.
Both are going to happen. What do you think about this tweet from Deez? Deez, I consider a good faith, profit maxi, tribally indifferent trader who's in it for the vibes. He's tweeting out the ETH BTC ratio and he just goes underwater beach ball. What do you, John, when you see this tweet, what do you see?
The chart looks good to me as someone who doesn't understand charts at all. I remember the last time someone asked me on a panel, like, what do you do for technical analysis or whatever?
You don't
answered,
do
I have
analysis.
Never drawn a line on a chart in my life, and I do not intend to draw a line on a chart. Not what I do.
Yeah, Brad, what do you think? Yeah, so like I hate that I can draw lines on charts and it makes me feel smart. Like I can I could do it. I was like, hey, that actually did
I
hit
do
this
feel
thing.
Smart like, when I draw lines
like,
on charts.
It actually did bounce whenever I drew this thing. Am I good? I think part of it is like a self-fulfilling prophecy. I don't ascribe any of that stuff here. Like just because the line's there doesn't mean shit, right? It's all like backwards looking to where like, oh, it invalidated the line, therefore my entire thesis changed and I no longer think it's a beach ball underwater. I think this thing's going to this crater to the center of Earth, right? So it's like it's always going to do that. So he's trying to be a little predictive here. But yeah, I also still disagree that like you need structural shit. Like you will have the splash on stuff that you're talking about, and but you like it's all about conviction that you can instill in people. Like that's all it is. You need to instill conviction in people like John, right? Who like he needs to see material things, and you need to instill like conviction in people who are just like all vibe space and like, yeah, man, it feels good. Like everyone's having a great time on the chain. Like I'm going to buy it because all my homies are buying it. Like, so you need to service all of these things. It's just the Johns of the world. And like, I'm starting to get into this camp of just like, I need to see more of like structural stuff in place of value accrual. And like, it's just not there. The one thing I am starting to get a little bit pilled on, and I even wrote about it, I think today in the response to the debate thing is like, we're talking about these nation states. Like if everyone's going to come on chain, right? We have all these RWAs that like everyone's starting to put more and more money on chain. Like Ethereum is like the place that most people would trust their a large amount of assets to be. Okay, cool. Like if you take that a little bit further and say like, well, smart contracts on Ethereum still aren't like totally trustless and like in an adversarial environment. Like I don't want Tether or Circle to be able to like unilaterally freeze my shit. So it's like if I have to accumulate ETH and I want to put assets on chain, or if I have to accumulate assets on chain, money on chain, I'm going to accumulate ETH because it's the only thing that like is truly like credibly neutral, permissionless, pristine, as Justin would like to say. It's like, it's the thing that no one has control over. And I do appreciate that outside of like maybe changing some inflation numbers periodically, but that's few and far between. That like, that gives the scaries to some people, but
and generally bullish, not bearish. Yeah. Changes. Yeah. I pointed out.
I would agree. Yeah. Like minimal inflation relative to the entire market. So like, so then like the next question is, okay, what do we think the global appetite for something like that is going to be on the long run? Right. If we think everyone's going to bring their assets on chain, we're talking 10 trillion, tens of trillions of dollars potentially. Okay. Like if you want to do that in an adversarial environment, are they going to accumulate ETH to sit there and hold on to it? Because that is the one asset across all of these chains that is like the best place to just like store your value, right? Or to like not have to worry about third party risk or counterparty risk. Maybe. But is that enough to pump the price to Valhalla? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I do think in the future when like central banks are counterparties to each other, that will be done on Ethereum, like without
like a terrorist negotiation, right? Like if North Korea wants to do a deal with like you guys, like look, man, like that they spin up a smart contract, it's publicly viewable. It's like I don't want anyone to be able to intercept this shit. They're gonna probably do it on Ethereum. Like that is the place where that entity has to do that thing for like some high stakes shit. It's gonna take like it's probably gonna take place on Ethereum mainnet. I can do it on Base, right? Base is gonna rug me and it's gonna steal all my shit. It's not gonna happen on Bitcoin. I can't even fucking do the thing. It's not programmable. Okay, it's not gonna be Solana because of whatever reason, right? So like now the question is like how much value is that, right? I don't know. That's the question.
Let's talk about hype really quick. We got the hype chart. We hit $42 with hype, which is, I believe, an all-time high. I was talking to a crypto Twitter legend who I will remain unnamed, but they said,
they're bearish Sol because of how well Hype is doing. What do you think about that line? Bearish Solana because how good Hyperliquid is doing. John, what do you think?
So, I mean, disclosure, I've said this a bunch of times before, but we own both. We own both Hype and Sol. I think it's fair to say that Sol is definitely starting to see at least the early stage difficulties that ETH has had over the past few years, which is, I mean, the largest part of it is it's really hard to move an asset that's $100 billion plus. It takes a lot of, you really got to show me something to convince me, hey, there's a lot of upside left on this thing. And so, I mean, very simply looking at Sol and Hype, I mean, what are the metrics that you can look at? Obviously, one of them is just like fees generated in some form. They're both like pretty comparable right now. So Sol's been running a bit ahead their REV relative to like Hype fees.
Really? Solana is generating as much fees as Hyperliquid is?
Yeah, they're in roughly the same ballpark. I think the ballpark has usually been that Sol is generating REV of like closer to actually $1 billion annualized.
Wow.
Possibly a little bit more. And Hyperliquid,
I thought Hyperliquid would be running circles around them.
Oh, no. Yeah, no. Hyperliquid is still behind Sol on like actual fees to the chain. And then Hyperliquid is in the ballpark. It's usually been in the $600 to $700 million annualized. Obviously, these numbers fluctuate up. At times, Sol has been much higher, especially. Sure. But that's ballpark, I believe, where they are right now is Hyperliquid somewhere in the ballpark of like $600 to $700 million annualized. And then Solana is like closer to $1 billion of REV.
Solana Rev was $1.4 billion last year.
Yeah. Wow. Like that sounds right. Yeah. So it's in the same ballpark, but Sol is like definitely higher. And the other part that's notable on that, and this gets into the, you know, apps versus platforms point, is if you look at what people are paying to Hyperliquid, it's not the Hyper EVM that's generating still at this point, even though people are talking about it, effectively a de minimis amount of fees, certainly relative to Hypercore. The vast majority of this is at the app level. That is what people are paying for versus on Sol. Obviously, these are platform level fees. This is REV. And on Solana, where is most of the money going? It's going to platforms like Pump. It's going to Axiom. It's going at the app layer. So there's certainly a lot more economic activity that's happening on Sol. It's just this Sol versus Hype is very emblematic of the current big meta question of platforms versus applications on top of them. What is actually going to be the revenue generator going forward? What is sticky? What really owns the user? So it's very much a bet on that kind of split. And even in Solana, I mean, this is why we've also been investing increasingly at the application layer, not just at the protocol layer as well, because that is where I think a lot of the stickiness is and a lot of users are going to gravitate there. So part of it is that of just, you know, do you build a first party application versus a totally general purpose platform? And then the other part of it is just sheer size. You know, Sol has hit 100 plus billion. And so people very naturally start looking for, okay, what's the next trade? What's the next Solana? People always want to hit, you know, what was the next Ethereum after Ethereum, you know, went at $80, that was Sol at $8. And people are saying, okay, what's the next one? Like, you got to hit the next one. And so people kind of like are naturally always looking for that. Hype is in a relatively good position for people just like psychologically want that kind of trade. And these are two of just the big applications and platforms in crypto that just currently are successful and people are using a lot.
Hyperliquid right now is at $40 billion versus Solana's $95 billion. So obviously still a gap, but not that large of a gap. And so I think the universal question that I'll ask as a representative of the Hype sidelined tribe, is it too late to buy Hype at $41, at $35 billion? Because, like, that doesn't make me feel good. Like, I feel like I'm just top blasting everyone's, like, $10 purchase that they bought during, like, the tariff scare.
It depends on what you think the general growth is going to look like. Yes, John is doing great at comparing, like, what is going on with Hyperliquid fee generation versus the rev of Solana. But like Rev was created as like a proxy to try to figure out demand for the actual block space on Solana. And then like to try to like determine, okay, what's the value accrual here, right? There's clearly a bunch of activity going on the chain. How much of that is going back to the native asset Solana? Like, do you apply a multiple to that? Like, you know, all of this stuff. Whereas like 100% of this shit that's being generated on Hype is like, I think it's 97% of the actual fees are going to Hype buyback. And that's instilling a lot of conviction. And then like you think
so
about
like
the growth.
A dollar generated by Hype revenue is worth like, I don't know, 5-10x more than a dollar worth generated by Solana revenue, because it just goes straight back to Hype buybacks.
Yeah, because some of that goes to like, well, we're gonna have the Pump ICO soon. Like, so like some of that's gonna be going to the Pump token eventually. I'm assuming it's some component. Like, some of it goes to Jito, some of it goes to like the Photon, you know, trading bot. So like it gets dispersed amongst a bunch of things. Whereas because Hype has created the tier one application, right? The native app, like basically all those fees go directly to just buying Hype the token, right? So, and then now it's kind of becoming a cult thing where like a lot of the actual applications being spun up on the Hyper course or the Hyper EVM side are kind of doing a similar thing. It's kind of like an honorary burn. I don't know how long that'll last because everyone's just going to profit max, but you know, it's kind of a thing. So, you know, I was top blasting the whole last like, you know, 3 weeks. So I bought from like 26 up to like 36 over the last few weeks. So I anticipated going a little bit higher. If you think it's going to continue to grow its moat, they're talking about like now a bunch of other DeFi or not DeFi, but blockchain native applications are buying tickers and trying to do their launch on Hype specifically, as opposed to doing it through centralized exchanges. They're talking about, you know, doing Unit to bring on much more assets. They're talking about HIP-3 is the big thing that everyone's discussing lately because it allows more and more units, or not units, more and more assets to be brought on chain to be traded. So like, if you think it'll continue to grow just by it being the virtue of it being a good product and people wanting exposure to Hype, then like, yeah, you can expect more revenues, which expect more bullishness, which expect price to go up a little bit more. At least that's my thesis.
I generally don't have a very strong opinion usually on value distribution mechanisms. I think in most cases, it doesn't make a tremendous difference whether you're taking in fees / RAV from users and using it to buy back and burn the token versus distribute it directly to stakers. I think there's a meaningful difference if you're redeploying it for growth, you know, if you're taking those funds aside and using it to grow the protocol. But if you're returning it to shareholders in some form, whether it's a buyback or staking, I don't think there's actually a tremendous difference. It's just a company doing dividends versus buybacks. It's not a huge difference to me. I think the bigger difference when you're evaluating platforms versus application level fees, and this is something we've swayed back and forth on, Brad, is I think the more important point to me is the depending on what type of activity you're using to generate these fees / REV, you may take a different view on how sticky those are and how much headroom they have to grow. And so you would apply potentially different multiples on them. Simple classic example would be, you know, if you looked at Ethereum fees back up from a few years ago where it was generating, I mean, the annualized run rate was something crazy. It was like $20 billion a year. But where was all of that coming from? It was just a shit ton of congestion fees. It was super, super high base fees. You know, people were just like yeeting $500 to get a Uniswap trade done. Like, obviously, that is not sustainable activity that you could project forward in any reasonable way whatsoever. That's like obviously going to go away at some point. Versus, I would say there's a higher degree of sustainability to a general purpose platform where, you know, users are paying right now a fair amount of priority fees and MEV. And this is where Solana value curl primarily is right now compared to ETH. The base fees are de minimis effectively, and there's a meaningful amount of priority fees and MEV. So I would say that's generally a stickier source of revenue compared to high base fees. I would say it's a little bit more durable going forward. But at the same time, apps are trying to eat into that margin too. And if there is too high a margin on priority fees and MEV, well, then they'll leave and go make their own chain if they're not able to internalize it on your chain. So even that's not perfect. And then I think generally the stickiest thing is going to be if you just have a killer application that people love to use and there is a big market for that to grow into, you will put a different valuation multiple on something that has revenue that you might assess to be a lot stickier, a lot more durable, and a lot more headroom to grow. So that does make a difference in what type of platform you're looking at. You know, what is the quality of this revenue that you're actually getting, and you know, how can I forecast that forward? So that does end up looking pretty different on a platform versus an application level.
Imagine if your checking account and DeFi wallet finally spoke the same language. That's Mantle Banking, an all-in-one fiat and crypto account. It lets you save, spend, and invest all from one dashboard. Swipe for coffee, stake ME3 yield, or even use virtual cards for payments through Apple Pay. So it feels Web2 simple, yet stays Web3 sovereign. For allocators, meet Mantle Index 4, the S&P 500 of crypto, a tokenized institutional-grade fund seeded with $400 million from the Mantle Treasury and balanced across Bitcoin, Ether, Sol, and yield-enhanced stables. One asset, broad exposure, pure DeFi composability. The momentum is real. ETH vaults, FBTC bridges, and a $2.4 billion community treasury are all powering the next phase of on-chain finance. Mantle brings real-world access, yield, and utility to digital assets. Ready for the next era of on-chain finance that actually belongs in 2025? Explore Mantle at mantle.xyz or follow Mantle_official. Mantle, bridging TradFi and DeFi so you don't have to. Imagine verifying yourself without handing over personal data. No hacked databases, no unnecessary personal exposure for airdrops, and no AI bots ruining community governance. Meet Self, the on-chain identity verification protocol built for privacy and control. Self protocol uses zero-knowledge proofs to confirm your identity safely. Users prove key details like age or citizenship without revealing sensitive personal information. Self never stores your data. It only generates cryptographic proofs. Here's how it works in three steps. First, register and verify. Use the Self app to scan your biometric passport's RFID chip. Self verifies authenticity with zero knowledge proofs. Each passport creates one unique identity. Second, you can share proofs privately. Third-party apps request identity proofs, like confirming you're over 18. You can also link proofs securely to public wallets for airdrops or governance participation. And then last, secure verification. Apps validate your proofs instantly on-chain, like on Celo, or off-chain. Audited by ZK Security, the Self app is live on iOS and Play Store. Visit self.xyz and follow Self Protocol on X.
There's two charts that will tell you a bearish or bullish story about Hyperliquid. This first one is Hyperliquid's market share around DeFi perps, so DEX perps. It's already at 78% market share in the DEX landscapes. Going from 78 to 88% is like pretty hard. And then also you're only growing that much more. Like, so like growth is tapped out on DEX perp. So like, where does Hyperliquid even go from here? Like, how does it get any bigger than this when it's already at like 80% of market share? And like, congrats, you've won when like your number two competitor is other. Like, it's just the other category. Like, you just won DEXs, but like you're also done. Like, there's no more market share for you to go to. That's the bearish case for Hyperliquid. The bullish case is looking at Hyperliquid versus Binance perps volumes, where weekly Hyperliquid volume, I think, has peaked out at 11% versus Binance's 88%. Hopefully this Dune dashboard is correct. But if you just look at Hyperliquid versus Binance, being like, well, it's only got 11% of Binance's market share. That's a whole lot of fees left on the table. It could just, if it goes 50-50% versus Binance, it's going to 3x its fees. And all of a sudden, that $40 billion to Solana's $95 billion does look pretty like justifiable. But I think it's really a function of just like, how well can Hyperliquid get Binance traders to migrate over to Hyperliquid? And why haven't they already? Like, why haven't they by now? I don't really, I'm not a perp trader, so I don't really know. I don't know if you guys, either of you have any like information here.
Yeah. So the difference or the edge that we had at MegaEth that like is encroaching specifically on what Hyperliquid is maybe losing to some of these centralized exchanges is that the centralized exchanges are just like, they're more performant, right? They don't have blockchain backends. They don't have to deal with latency. They don't have to deal with block times. So they're very, very performant. And the most said is a downstream of like needing consensus, right? It takes time to actually like agree on something, which then makes it then true. Like, they do some stuff to get around that. But for us, like, if you have, or this is L2s broadly, if you have a chain that has a centralized or a predictable block builder, right, then you can co-locate next to this thing. Then you can start to encroach on some of these performance numbers that centralized exchanges actually can tout, right? So like, this is like a comparison against GTE, which is one of our applications building on MegaEth. Like, they're working specifically with market makers so that they can co-locate next to our sequencer, so that, you know, the latency round trip for them to actually execute this stuff on chain, if it's cheap enough, is, you know, in single digit milliseconds, right? And because you can afford that stuff, or because you can get some predictable outcomes from the construction. So like, if volume is the metric that just says like, these are the things we want to capture and we want to bring that stuff on chain, this is a vertical that we're actually trying to push for, because Hyperliquid may not ever be able to encroach on that, because yeah, they have a distributed validator set as an L1, right? If you're doing that, then you necessarily can have a little bit of delay for achieving consensus. So, you know, will they ever be able to eat into GTE because of that fallback? We are not GTE, but for Binance, because of that latency fallback, who knows? But that's the vertical that they're pushing for.
So what you're saying is this gap between the like 75% market share that Hyperliquid has on the DEX side of things versus the like 9% market share that it has versus Binance, that gap is the latency of the actual market.
Yeah, it's just saying like this is volumes, right? Volumes right. Are going to be mostly dictated by these very large players that are doing high frequency trading, you know, tens to hundreds of millions of dollars pretty consistently. And they do that stuff because there's some properties that they can count on, whether it's not too expensive for them to execute the order. They can get rid of toxic flow. They have latency expectations for like interacting with the thing that is actually taking the order. And it's like, will they ever leave the confines of a centralized exchange that can say, look, bro, you can get your order on chain for free or not on chain, but you can get your order in the order book on chain, or fuck, it keeps saying it, on the order book in single digit milliseconds for free. Like, will they ever leave that environment to go to a public ecosystem like Hyperliquid that it costs money to put your order on? You have to deal with toxic flow for ordering. Like, will they ever opt into that? Maybe not, because the performance is not going to actually really be able to keep up on the latency side with a centralized counterpart. But like, maybe the middle ground becomes a construction like an L2, where you, these market makers can co-locate next to a sequencer, which is the block builder. It doesn't have consensus, so you don't have to worry about the delayed block time. It's a much more predictable environment.
Well, I'm going to agree with half and then disagree with half. I agree the half that matters is the centralized exchange side. I don't agree that latency is actually the determining factor here, or the reason why users or market makers are primarily on these exchanges. I think the very direct risk to Hyperliquid is primarily that, for example, you can imagine perps getting legalized within the US and having a regulatory framework around that in the short to medium term. Like, there's clearly regulatory and institutional interest in that happening. And then the question is, okay, Robinhood and Coinbase have perps now. What do you use? Do you use Hyperliquid or do you use Coinbase? I as a US citizen do not use Hyperliquid, but if I were to hypothetically use a perps platform in the United States in New York, I would probably have to use one that does not KYC and take my documents in the way that Binance does. So you could imagine some of those users may be using Hyperliquid now, but they might go use Coinbase or Robinhood should that option present itself to them. I don't think that's a latency consideration to them. I think that's just the fact that they own the user and they're a good product, and I trust them with my funds. And empirically, I mean, most users are getting their face ripped off when they trade on Coinbase and Robinhood. Like, they're not paying these cheat fees for best execution. And market makers are increasingly, to my understanding, I mean, the big market makers really are on Hyperliquid, and it is quite profitable flow. And it's not entirely clear to me that reducing latency further based on where they are is actually going to meaningfully improve execution, particularly within the fast batches where they do have prioritized and free cancels, which does help the market makers a lot. So my understanding is like that they are trading there now, most of the meaningful ones, and they are doing well, and users obviously love it. The bigger issue to me is the regulatory clarity that comes around perps. And then you assume that all the major players who are currently being held back right now, do they come in and squish the market? Does Coinbase come in? Does Robinhood come in? And do they win the market now that that is the best available option to most users? Does Hyperliquid still have a product market fit after that?
Do we have a regulatory event with Hyper in the future, do you think? Like, obviously, you just called out like the KYC, like not being a requirement for coming to operate on chain.
Yeah, I mean, this is a risk to them existing right now, is that there is very unclear regulatory clarity for, I mean, pretty much all decentralized DeFi protocols. But I mean, especially someone like Hyperliquid, that obviously is not KYCing and is a somewhat decentralized network. But this is all the stuff that gets into like the market structure bill too, and a lot of the legislation and that regulators are thinking of is what is a sufficiently decentralized or sufficiently mature network? Like, what exactly is your definition of that allows you to operate differently than a centralized counterparty? And that's all TBD still. So yeah, it's certainly a risk for them.
It strikes me as like a Tether versus Circle debate with how their approach to the market, where like everyone has funded Hyperliquid specifically of like, oh, unregulated exchange, you're doing all this stuff and there's no KYC, you're going to get funded, which is like, that's what's been pushed back against Tether for the longest time. It's like, oh my God, they don't have any like audits. You can't tell who's doing what. Like, there's just a lot of opaqueness to the actual system itself. But it like, because it just like asked for forgiveness as opposed to permission, it got an incredible amount of network effects, and like it's all throughout the ecosystem now. I wonder if it might be similar with Hyperliquid, where like they like, yeah, it's probably not like the best way to go about this thing if you're doing it by the book, but like they've undoubtedly like 75% market share, right? Like, it's crazy. Like, if they continue to go down that path, does it get to a point where it's just like, all right, we'll ask for forgiveness, pay some dollars, and then we're on our way?
I don't know if that's the right comparison. I think the better comparison, because Tether hasn't done anything illegal. Like, there's nothing wrong about like Tether's business. Like, you can call it shady and opaque, but I don't know if there's any pointing of fingers of anything actually illegal being done there. I think the much better comparison for Hyperliquid is BitMEX, which did like get in trouble for violating the Bank Secrecy Act and not KYCing their users and being just like laissez-faire about users on their exchange. And they were an absolutely centralized exchange. And like, again, all of the laws that pointed towards BitMEX being illegal, I don't necessarily respect myself. I think those are bad laws that should go away. But those would be the same laws that would be pointed to Hyperliquid. And so I'm not sure that the Tether versus Hyperliquid comparison is apt.
Yeah, I think it's more just like having a dollar backing every dollar on chain kind of situation, where like everyone always questions of like, oh, if you're going to be doing this thing, this is how you should be doing it. If they claim that there's someone that has a dollar for every dollar, but they had not done any proof of reserves up to this point, like that was always the FUD that I had always seen. It's just like, look, they the bot would go off on Twitter where you'd see like, oh, Tether just printed $100 gajillion. And it's just like, did you just get 100? Like, do you actually have that money?
$1 trillion printed at the Tether treasury.
Yeah. So like you would see that stuff and like, is that like illegal? Like, like, I don't know what their claims are, or like what like all the regulations are, but like it's the same tactic in my opinion. If it's something that's kind of like, okay, like we're starting to get into a territory that's whatever, but it's undoubtedly been good for their network effects.
Let's get into the last topic of the week. PumpFun planning a $1 billion token sale coming in at $4 billion valuation. So this is a combination of an airdrop that I think has been more or less confirmed, along with $1 billion of sales from private investors, and then also sales on exchanges to like retail investors, I think at an ICO. I'm actually a little bit fuzzy on the mechanism, but this is the news that went around the shot heard around the ecosystem. I think that the reactions to this have been mixed. This is obviously very pricey. So the individuals who are able to get in into this pump sale are coming in at a $4 billion valuation. So that's already priced in pretty well. Growth is already pretty priced in. But otherwise, like the exciting thing is that a pump token is confirmed, and then pump airdrop is like all but confirmed. And so it's a pretty big moment for this ecosystem. And then there are different takes, of course, as you would imagine. Some people are pointing at this being bullish. Some people are pointing at this being like, well, this is the end. This is the top. And then also other people are saying like, why do they need $1 billion for? And that, which is a whole other thing. I think the one thing of note is Pump is going for a like sitting shoulder to shoulder with some very big Web2 gargantuans like Twitch. And it's going to try and be like a creator streaming platform that just has a token aside with it as well. Well, as like presented front and center. But it's interesting to see Pump, the long term, the end game for Pump, trying to sit shoulder to shoulder with a streaming platform, which is interesting because they're really leaning into like the creator economy side of things. John, what's your take when you saw this?
The immediate reaction for myself, which was mostly a counter reaction to what people were on Twitter, I saw a lot of the stories at first were quite, a lot of the reactions at first were quite funny, saying this is extractive of, oh, they've been extracting for the past year or two, and now this is their final.
What do they need $1 billion for after they made $700 million in cumulative revenue? Like that was a big reaction. Yeah.
It was just quite funny to me of crypto is the most, you know, we're supposed to be free markets people in the world, and then they will call it extraction unironically when you have the most successful consumer app in crypto, which users pay willingly to use, pay them money, and then they also sell a share in this profitable protocol openly at a price that like anyone can participate in, and that's extractive. So I don't think it's extractive. I understand that obviously a lot of people don't like meme coins. I mean, my view on this has been very consistent for a very long time of, I think people just really over intellectualize the hell out of meme coins. I don't think they're that complicated. They're fun. They're mostly a new form of gambling. Just like be direct about that. And it's cool. Casinos are a real market in the real world. I mean, this is effectively new internet native on-chain casino as it stands right now. I mean, obviously also hopefully this progresses into more real productive assets and stuff like that over time. But meme coins right now, and that has product market fit, love it or hate it. Like this is a protocol that has had serious product market fit over the last year, has generated a ton of money, and like actually makes sense. And so it's emblematic of that trend that we were talking about before again of, you know, what are the interesting areas in crypto of, you know, this progression from fat protocol thesis to fat application thesis. Obviously, Solana and Pump are right in the middle of that, that has been the hot chain and this has been the hot application for the past year or so. And where it's similar to Hyperliquid, where it's running a comparable revenue run rate to Hyperliquid over the past year, like quite consistently again of, I think they generated something like $700 million over the past year, which is ballpark about like half of what Sol has been doing. So, I mean, obviously anyone can do their own, like look at the asset themselves, like everyone free to make their own interpretation. But it's not hard to see why people are like looking at Pump and interested in it as one of the very few incredibly successful applications that we have seen in crypto that has a lot of product market fit right now. And yeah, to that point of the, you know, going on and competing against a lot of Web2 incumbents, you can imagine that's where a lot of capital needs would come from. It is not cheap to go take on, you know, Twitch and Binance at the same time. You can go look at what are the top streamer contracts. You can go look them up online. Like they're gigantic. And they're very much aggressively going after this blend of this inevitable collision course between social and finance that is like very, very directly coming. And they are very much right in the center of that, trying to build out the social and streaming platform, really owning the user, and then financializing all of that and having the trading infrastructure around that. That's a very big vision, and it's a very expensive vision to build out, which they've done a very good job at over the past year. So it's understandable what they could use the funds for.
You guys have $100 to allocate at Pump at $4 billion or Hype at $40 billion. How do you allocate that $100?
All into Pump. 10x cheaper, all into Pump, for sure. I think Hype can do a 2x or 3x.
Kobe was calling for 150 today.
Kobe was what?
Called for 150 Hype. He's like, I think 120 to 150 makes sense, but I don't know when or how it gets there.
Kobe's very long Hype. That is a 4x. That's a 4x. And so I think at Kobe's size, like 4xing is pretty good. But like Pump, if I've only got $100, like I'm throwing it on the smallest market cap thing possible. And $4 billion, that seems fine. And a fresh new chart, you know? John, what would you do?
No opinion, no investment advice. Everyone do what they please with their own money. I think both are great, successful applications. Like I understand the investment case that people are making for both of them. I mean, the very simple thing that you could do is go look at what are the big money makers in crypto over the past year or two. It's these two protocols head and shoulders above everyone else at the application level. It's Sol, and then maybe it's like Tron. And then you take basically a big leap down at that point. Yeah. And then you have like Ethereum and Sky and a number of these other protocols that are great. But I mean,
and even a lot of Solana's revenue came downstream of Pump is because of Pump.
If you look at the correlation, if you look back, I've seen people post charts about this. If you just look at the correlation of Pump fee revenue over time and Sol REV over time, they're very, very highly correlated, which is unsurprising. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the interesting comparison too that a lot of people will make. Is it, in many ways, obviously, Solana is at least at this stage highly reliant upon a lot of speculative trading, a lot of meme coin activity. And in many ways, this is the clearer value expression of, you know, hey, I think that meme coin activity is a real thing. I think that this is a actual sustainable application that people like to use. What is the right level to express that view? And PumpFund and Solana are obviously the two different layers of that, the application versus the platform layer. I think that's a very interesting comparison that you're going to see a lot of people making. And obviously, you've seen a lot of people speculating also over the past few days, you know, hey, is this why Sol is underperforming lately? You know, are people taking that view? Very literally, where are people going to get capital from to put this in? You know, you can imagine a portion of that is going to be people who are selling Sol. It's a lot of the same audience. It's this very fat protocol thesis to fat application thesis trend that we're starting to play out here, where people are getting very interested in the applications that generate a lot of money again.
John, Brad, it's been another week. Really appreciate you guys coming on and giving me your thoughts. I always learn a lot.
Thanks, dude.
Bankless Nation, you guys know the deal. Crypto is risky. You can lose what you put in, but nonetheless, we are headed west. This is Frontier. It's not for everyone, but we are glad you are with us on the Bankless journey. Thanks a lot.